You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
When you get to the show in the morning and you go down and you look at the course, and like I said earlier, we all know the places where we could have trouble. Like maybe your horse has a slow lead change, or maybe there's a bending line and you know your horse is going to land right and it would be more helpful if it landed left. And it's easy to be like, just start talking negatively, like, oh, I'm worried I'm going to miss the lead change, or I'm worried about this, or I'm worried about that. And we try to put it in like a more positive spin. Like instead of saying, I'm worried I'm going to miss the lead change after the first jump, we try to talk about what you need to do in order to make it so you don't miss the lead change after the first jump. What, you know, make sure you have enough pace to the first jump, make sure you land from the first jump and ride away and step out into your outside stirrup, or, you know, whatever it is. But we talk a lot about the power of positive thinking, or like putting your nerves into action instead of just thinking negatively and worrying and being concerned about what could go wrong.
Welcome to the Practical Horseman Podcast, featuring conversations with respected riders, industry leaders, and horse care experts. The show is co-hosted by Practical Horseman editors, and our goal is to inform, educate, and inspire. I'm Kathleen Landwehr, and this week's episode is with hunter, jumper, trainer, and rider, Amanda Stege. Amanda and I spoke in mid-March as the winter circuit was winding down for her, her clients, and her horses, after solid performances at the World Equestrian Center Ocala. To give you a little more background on Amanda, she grew up on her parents' Red Acre farm in Stowe, Massachusetts. Amanda had a successful junior career in the equitation, hunter, and jumper rings. Then she went off to Boston College to figure out her future, only riding during the summers. After earning a psychology degree in 1998, she returned to the horse world ready to take the leap into becoming a professional. Amanda worked for several trainers before going off on her own and starting her premier hunter jumper show, training, and sales business, Ash Meadow Farm, based in Ocala, Florida, and Califon, New Jersey. Over the years, Amanda has had several top results in the hunter ring with horses such as Unseen, Candlelight, Kingpin, Mirror Image, Baloo, and most recently, Lafitte de Meuse. With Lafitte, Amanda has won the 2021 $50,000 WCHR Peter Wetherill Palm Beach Hunter Spectacular, the 2005 High Performance Hunter Champion title at the Devon Horse Show, and is a three-time winner of the WCHR Professional Challenge, just to name a few of their results. In our discussion, Amanda talks about what she enjoys about the hunter discipline, her training philosophy, her special partnership with Lafitte, and more. Before getting into the conversation with Amanda, I'd like to share a word from this episode's sponsor, Equa Analytical. At Equa Analytical, we know the importance of a well-balanced diet for your horse. Our laboratory can test hay, pasture, water, or any type of feed you give your horse and provide a nutrient analysis report. This information is significant for the well-being of your horse. To learn more or submit a sample for testing, visit equaanalytical.com today. Now, let's jump right into the conversation with Amanda, where she talks about why horses have kept her involved with the sport.
I grew up on a farm. My parents have a business in Stowe, Massachusetts. So just early on, I think I just loved horses and loved being around them. And I love the interactions that I have with them and the bonds and relationships that I've formed with them. And I think my horses that are competitive at the highest level, they really enjoy it. I mean, they're athletes and they're perfectionists, and they seem to know that when they walk in the ring that they're performing and they're doing something. And I think they want to be out there just as much as I want to be out there. I've always had a real interest in developing young horses. So we buy a lot of horses as 4-year-olds or 5-year-olds or 6-year-olds and bring them along in the sport. And it's really rewarding to see how the horses change and develop over the years. And it's fun when you go back to the same shows on a horse that maybe was a 6-year-old last year and now he's a 7-year-old, and to see and feel how much different that horse is and how his body has developed and how his body development has changed his jump and his level of competition and results. So I think all those things are sort of what has kept me going and what drives me in the sport.
Sure. Now that's so neat to think too, especially when, like how you said, you work with young horses and they progress and you see that progression, and I can just, very rewarding.
Yes.
You are focused on the hunter divisions. What made you kind of gravitate towards those divisions? Did you start out in those divisions or end up in that?
Actually, as a junior, I did everything. I had a really fun hunter to ride named One in a Million as a kid. And most people that know me from back then sort of equate me with that horse. His name was Spanky in the barn. And he was a wonderful horse that I did in the children's hunters and then the junior hunters. And he also was my equitation horse. So he also did medal in McClay finals. And one of my earliest memorable wins came on that horse. I won the Massachusetts medal finals in 1991. But along with that horse as a junior, I also showed in the jumpers, and I got to show my dad's sort of Grand Prix horse that was coming down a few levels. And then I worked for Peter Wilde for a year in between high school and college, and I showed jumpers for him. And I enjoyed that. But after college, when I started my professional career, my earliest successes were on hunters. People, Megan McGuire actually was my first client, and she sent me two wonderful hunters, one of which was named Candlelight. And that was the first horse that I won classes at Devon and the National Horse Show. And I trained Megan to championships at Harrisburg and Devon in the amateur divisions. So that just sort of started my hunter career. And then from there, I just felt like I wanted my business to be relatively small and boutique-like. And the best way to do that was for everybody to be doing the same thing. So I geared my business towards hunters, and in particular towards young hunters and mostly amateur clients. I do have a few amateurs that have jumpers now, and you will see me from time to time at the jumper ring, but I don't think I've competed myself on a jumper for many years.
Okay, that's very interesting to hear, you know, your background. And I love that kind of the, you know, boutique business that you have and what works best for you and your clients.
Exactly.
And you kind of touched on one of my next questions with One in a Million. Can you talk about some of the most influential horses in your life, who they are, what they're like, and why they are influential?
Sure. Yeah. So like I said, Spanky or One in a Million, that would sort of be the first horse that I had that had these qualities we were talking about earlier, that was just really enjoyed being a show horse and going to the ring and would raise his game. Like the better, higher level the horse show, the harder he would try. And you felt like he just really loved it. And I won the Massachusetts medal finals on Spanky. And then he was my first horse that I got to go to Devon and indoors and compete in the small junior hunters, as well as the medal in McClay finals. So he was definitely a very important and influential horse to my career. And then I went to Boston College for 4 years, where I only rode in the summers. So I did school for a while, and I graduated in 1998. And my first sort of high level professional horses, the first one was a horse named Unseen. We called him Alex in the barn. He was owned by Annie and Nancy Connolly, and he was champion at Devon in 2001 in the second year division. So that was a big deal for me. Devon's a big deal for everybody, but in particular for my mother's family, who are not horse people. They grew up outside of Philadelphia, and my grandparents would always come to watch at Devon, and it's such a hard horse show to win at. So that was a wonderful accomplishment and a horse that definitely helped put me on the map as far as my professional career. And he was quickly followed by Candlelight, who was Megan McGuire's wonderful chestnut mare that she showed in the Amateur Hunters, and I showed in the, it was regular working then, High Performance Now, and got to win multiple blue ribbons at, again, those sort of top tier horse shows. And then probably moving on from there, I was lucky enough to catch ride some wonderful horses for Jimmy and Ellen Toon. One of them was named Kingpin, and another was named Mirror Image. Both of those horses were champions at Devon. And then my client, Lisa Arena, we bought a young horse named Baloo from Kate Conover and Amos Spadone. This is, I don't know, probably 15 years ago now, but I developed Baloo starting at the green 3 foot level all the way up through second years. And then he became a wonderful amateur partner for Lisa. And he was quite influential for me. And then we moved into the Lafitte era, which has been, you know, 9 years already that I've been showing Lafitte. And certainly many of my most memorable wins have come on him. I think his first year being in the United States, he won the $500,000 class at Saugerties, which was a big deal. To win $150,000 in prize money for a hunter, I think, is not something that we get to do all the time. And that first year he was here at Capital Challenge, he won all 4 jumping classes in the green 3'6" division, and he won the professional challenge. So that was a huge week, and he's gone on to win that professional challenge 2 other times. So all of those were very exciting and memorable wins, as well as winning the Hunter Spectacular in Palm Beach was a big one. And he's won the Derby at Upperville the last 2 years. I think last year he won it by 25 points.
So wow.
That was very exciting class. And it was just a class that had so many spectators and a horse show that has so much history. So that was sort of one of those wins that I'll always remember. But it's funny. I have actually a little necklace. I don't have it on right now, but a few years ago, my client, Lisa Arena Davis, asked me for some of the names. I think there's 6 names on it. She asked me for some of the names of, you know, my favorite horses or most memorable horses. And then she had this necklace made. And it's funny because I think that those necklaces are supposed to be like your children's names. So I was thinking, imagine what the people making the necklace thought, because it's like Spanky, Bruno, Candle, Baloo, Lafitte. She must be like, wow, this lady has some really original child names out there.
Oh, that's great. I love that your client made that for you, Anya, the names of all those special horses.
Yeah.
It seems like you have a really special partnership with Lafitte. Can you talk about his personality and what he is like to ride and train?
Oh, I mean, I think his personality is a lot like mine. He's just like, he's very, very intelligent. That's the number one thing about him. I've never been around a horse that communicates with you on the same level that he does. Like, he has a way of looking you right in your eye and you just know exactly what he's thinking and feeling. He really loves to go to the horse show ring more than any horse I've ever seen. And it's not just something that I notice, but people say it. Like, we do these classes, we're at the World Equestrian Center Ocala in the winter, and most of his classes are on Friday nights. And when he walks down there and like, it's like a night class and he crosses onto like the area where like the horse show is going, he looks very calm and very confident, but he just has this like sparkle in his eye or this twinkle in his eye that, that people comment on all the time. And they just are like, it's just crazy how much this horse loves to do this even 9 years later. He's very much a perfectionist. He's also very opinionated. He's like, there's a lot of rules with Lafitte. Like he, you know, things he loves to do, like he is going to do 110%. And if it's something that he doesn't love to do, it takes a lot of convincing to talk him into it. He's very, I would call him very sensitive. He's very aware. He's quite funny. Like he loves to go outside in the paddock and he likes to maybe not let you catch him unless like he thinks he's ready to come in. And yeah, I don't know. He's the absolute best. And I feel so lucky to have him. But I do feel like we are a match, and you know, other people tried Lafitte before me and it didn't work for them. And I do think that he was sort of waiting for me to come and find him.
Oh, wow. It's great to hear about a bit more about him. Cause yeah, it just seems like y'all have, like you said, 9 years and a lot of great results. And it's just, you're a fun pair to see go into the ring. So.
Oh yeah. Thank you so much.
You kind of mentioned with talking about your kind of most influential horses, some important wins you've had in your career. Are there any other wins that come to mind that are really important ones?
I think I touched on most of them. Like we said, my first big win was the Massachusetts Medal Finals. That was in 1991, I think. And what was really cool about that win was I was only showing in the Children's Hunters at that time. And that is a 3-foot medal finals, but all of the kids that were preparing for like the Medal and McClay finals, sort of from the New England area, also competed in that class. So I was definitely the underdog in that class and it wasn't really expected for me to win that class. And so it's just one that I guess I'll always remember. And then, yeah, probably, like I said, the Devon champion on Unseen was memorable. It was just my first. A lot of people at that time that are relevant in the sport probably didn't even really know me because we mostly showed in the New England area. And that horse show is so magical and special. So that one, all the Devon champions, I think, are ones that I'll remember. So that was Unseen, Kingpin, Mirror Image, and Lafitte. Lafitte actually just got his first Devon champion last year. He had been reserve champion there many years and just always something happened that prevented him from being champion. And he was champion there last year in the high performance. He got a 96 in the state class. So I feel like he was like, Mom, we're doing this year. We're not taking any chances. I mean, well, lots of Derby wins and things like that, but I think that Upperville one stands out. The Capital Challenge wins. Again, it's a little bit like Devon. It's fun to win at horse shows where there's so many people in the stands. And, oh, I guess one I did forget is the first year that I won the Lafitte won the Hunter Classic at the National Horse Show. And you won a car. Well, it was a lease on a car. But so at the end, like after you do the victory gallop, like you get in the car and drive around the ring. So that was fun. And again, a you know, high level horse show with a lot of spectators.
You know, the sport is so fun. I feel like, especially too, when you have a lot of spectators watching and cheering you on, and horses like Lafitte who just kind of light up in that atmosphere and seem to really thrive.
Yeah, we really love doing these classes at WEC that they have these derbies. Well, they have derbies every Friday, but I think there's 4 or 5 Fridays where the derbies go in the stadium, which is this huge ring with like tons of seats. And it's usually a night class for Lafitte. And he has quite a fan base that comes and watches him. And it's really fun to perform in front of all of his fans.
So kind of thinking about the opposite end of the spectrum with competing, you know, things don't always go as planned and maybe you don't win as much as you would hope. How do you handle kind of some disappointments if, you know, it's not your day?
Well, luckily I practiced losing a lot early on. I it took me a while to sort of get to the level that I am at now. So I think I learned very early in this sport that you need to appreciate the wins, but that the losses are something that comes, and you just have to try to step away from them and evaluate what went wrong and what maybe you can work on to improve for the next time. I don't know if you were at Derby Finals the year that, well, so Lafitte has never won Derby Finals. And a couple of years ago, I won the first round at Derby Finals and I went back last in the handy round and he was like absolutely spectacular. And when I landed from the last jump and the crowd erupted, he spooked and he like sort of took off and bucked a little and did a lead change off of his lead and then back onto his lead. And I think the judges, you know, there was three judging panels and I think they didn't really know what to do. And one panel still gave him a 94 and the other two panels gave him an 80. So I went from first to fifth and, you know, I certainly understand why the other two panels did what they did. They probably could have given him a 60, but anyways, that was certainly a very large defeat. That was a hard loss to stomach. And certainly I wasn't upset with Lafitte and not even upset with the judges or the crowd, but it was just like one of those things where it was hard because it was very much out of my control. There wasn't really anything I could have done to change that, but you just have to carry on and get out there the next time and do your best.
And with kind of a lot of the competitions you mentioned, there's, you know, a lot of crowds and hype and everything. Do you get nervous when you compete? And if so, how do you handle your nerves?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've always am nervous. The level of nerves changes depending on the class, but I am always have a little bit of nerves, and that's something that I've had my whole life and always had to learn to deal with. I actually find them to be a positive thing. I feel like if there's a moment where I'm not nervous, then I need to evaluate sort of what I'm doing and where I'm at in my career, because I feel like, you know, I'm nervous because I really care and I really want to do a good job for myself, for the horses, for the clients. You know, I want everything to go perfectly. And the second that I don't have a little bit of the butterflies or a little bit of that in my stomach, it's maybe an indication that I need to think about what I'm doing. But certainly at high level shows, especially when I was much younger, the nerves were something I really had to learn how to deal with. And I was a psychology major at Boston College and specifically sports psychology. So I use a lot of the things that I learned on myself. I do a lot of visualizing. Especially back at the day in the beginning, I would be at Devon with only candlelight and she showed in the 4 foot. So I would just sort of be sitting around all day watching Scott go around like 50 rounds before he got to the 4 foot. And I was just like, the tension would be building for me. So I developed the tactics of visualizing and just finding a quiet spot and going over the course in my head. And actually it's when I do it, it's almost like I'm watching a video of myself. It's almost like I've already done it and I'm playing back the video. And I can like see myself on the horse in my outfit and see the course and the crowd and the whole thing. And when I'm really nervous, when I first watch it, I'll make a mistake, you know, I'll chip a jump or, you know, something will go wrong. And then if that happens, I make myself rewind it and start over until I can watch myself doing the course really well. And I can hear the crowd and the clapping. And then I sort of zoom in on, you know, we all know our horses. We know like what turn you have to use a little extra inside leg or, you know, where the problem areas might be for you or your horse. So I make myself zoom in on what my body was doing in that particular spot. And I found that to be amazingly helpful. A, it like allows me to sort of focus my nerves and my attention on something. But B, after I've done that, I feel like when I go in the ring, my body just naturally does some of the things that I was concentrating on in my visualizing.
Just can see how that, yeah, just so beneficial to set yourself up for success by having gone through it multiple times and maybe even gone through some mistakes and smoothed those over with the visualization. So that's awesome.
We also talk a lot about this with some of my amateur clients. You know, when you get to the show in the morning and you go down and you look at the course, and like I said earlier, we all know the places where we could have trouble. Like maybe your horse has a slow lead change, or maybe there's a bending line and you know your horse is going to land right and it would be more helpful if it landed left. And it's easy to be like, just start talking negatively, like, oh, I'm worried I'm going to miss the lead change, or I'm worried about this, or I'm worried about that. And we try to put it in like a more positive spin, like instead of saying, I'm worried I'm going to miss the lead change after the first jump, we try to talk about what you need to do in order to make it so you don't miss the lead change after the first jump. What, you know, make sure you have enough pace to the first jump, make sure you land from the first jump and ride away and step out into your outside stirrup, or, you know, whatever it is. But we talk a lot about the power of positive thinking, or like putting your nerves into action instead of just thinking negatively and worrying and being concerned about what could go wrong.
Yeah, that's awesome. I feel like, you know, if someone's working with their trainer and thinking about the course, they might maybe be hesitant to share some of their like worries, but that's great to kind of be like, share them and work.
Oh, not my ladies. They, I guess I have a lot of worriers. They like to tell me like all the things, and we're like, no, we're not talking like that. We're going to talk about this, you know.
Do you have a big routine, like big competitions that you follow? Some people I know are superstitious or treat it like any other day.
Well, I mean, I am very superstitious, and I have blue everything. Like my nails are always blue. Like everything I have is like blue ribbon blue. So while I'm competing, my nails are always like this same blue color. So you always know if we have like downtime, if it's like November or April and we're not showing, then my nails are pink or red. But like anytime we're like actively going to competitions, I always have like my lucky blue nails, and I have like a blue watch and a blue bracelet, and I wear lucky blue underwear, and like, yes. So all of that, like I'm definitely a little bit superstitious about things like that and certain things that I wear. As far as my routine, I mean, at the normal show, we're really just so busy. Like, I mean, we get to the show at 4:30 or 5 or 5:30 in the morning, and we start preparing the horses. And then you just sort of get on your schedule and you're just going from class to class. And so I don't know that I really have much of a sort of ritual or routine at those shows. I mean, other than the fact that I'm always really good about making sure I know my courses early, and I polish my boots at the end of every day, and, you know, just normal things like that. But at these higher level competitions, like at a Derby finals or when I have a big night class, I definitely always try to find at least an hour where I can go back to the hotel or go back to my house and change my clothes and just, you know, I'm not really a napper, but like just have a little bit of a quiet moment to sort of regroup my thoughts. And I definitely think that's always helped me. And also just trying to plan out eating something. Like, I think because I can be a little nervous, I used to be hard for me to remember to like eat. And then you would have these night classes that don't get over till like 9 or 10 p.m. And then you're just like dying after. So like, I've gotten a lot better about trying to like plan out my eating habits and making sure that I, you know, have enough protein and stuff at some point before these classes.
Oh yeah. That's so true to set yourself up for success with food and a little bit of blue as well.
Exactly.
So thinking about training, what is your training philosophy?
So there's a couple parts to that, I would say. I mean, one of the things that I learned very early on, and I can actually sort of go back to having candlelight and remembering this, is that I think a lot of training horses, more than I even thought, has to do with making sure that they're physically at their best. So a lot of my training philosophy involves like making sure I have the right team surrounding me as far as like the farrier and the vet and the chiropractor and the massage therapist and like having people that are not only really good at their job, but that are good at working together. Because I sort of learned early on, like you have a horse that wants to swap off its lead, or you have a horse that has one lead change that's harder than the other. I'm not saying that there's not some level of training that goes into that, but I learned very early that 8 times out of 10 or 9 times out of 10, those tend to be physical ailments, or not even ailments, but like maybe one side of the horse is developed more than the other side of the horse. And that the better that I could make the horses feel, the easier it was to work on some of those issues. So I think that's probably one part of my philosophy, is to really address the whole body of the horse and the physical concerns of the horse, like as you're doing your training. In addition to that, like a good deal of our training is working on flat work and adjustability and strengthening in the horses and getting them out of the ring. We know we try to ride out in the fields and on the hills and making sure that their body is fully developed and able to handle the things that we're asking them to do in the ring. So we do a lot of cavalettis. We do a lot of pull work, a lot of working on adjustability and lengthening and shortening. Also quite a few gymnastics, and those gymnastics change based on the horse and the age of the horse and the level of the horse. We do a little bit of practicing courses and jumping courses at home, but I would say we do much less jumping than you would think, and a lot more flat work and low jumps and gymnastics. It's not a lot of actually doing a course at home like you would see in the horse show ring.
I love what you said, kind of just the whole picture with making sure they're feeling their best, because they're really athletes and, you know, working with the vet and the farrier and everything. And then kind of, yeah, not too much jumping at home. It definitely seems to be common for, you know, when horses are definitely established, it's kind of those different exercises.
Yeah. And I mean, we're big believers in turnout. I mean, our horses all go outside, you know, pretty much every day that they're not traveling away at a horse show. So that's definitely part of it. But I don't really believe in like downtime per se. I mean, I believe in time away from the show, and I think it's important that the horses aren't overshown. But in our, we don't ever show in November or December or in April, but we still ride the horses 6 days a week. I know some people like to just give the horses complete time off, and that's not something that's ever worked for me. Again, I consider them athletes, and even like after Lafitte has a big night class, like on a Friday night, I always get on him first thing on Saturday morning, and I'm not working him hard, but I'm taking him out and stretching his body and loosening his muscles. And sometimes I'll get comments from people like, oh, like, doesn't Lafitte get a day off? And I mean, I guess my reaction is like, after people play in the Super Bowl, I don't think they like sit on the couch the next day and eat bonbons. Like, I think it's important to remember that they're athletes, and when they work hard like that, they could wake up feeling, you know, tight. And I'm certainly not taking him out to ride him for 2 hours the next day, but I like to get on him and stretch his legs and make sure he feels good. And then he goes home and goes out in his paddock for a while.
Do you have a favorite training exercise, and can you describe it?
So it's a little bit of a hard question, because that varies, you know, by the horse and by the situation. And, you know, if I'm working with my amateur ladies or if I'm working with Lafitte. Lafitte has a gymnastic that we do every morning that he has a big class. And I actually feel like at this point he like knows how important the class is by whether we do the gymnastic or not. But his gymnastic is a rail on the ground, 9 feet to a vertical, 9 feet to a rail on the ground, 9 feet to a vertical, 9 feet to the rail on the ground. And I do it off both leads. And I want him to come to the exercise. Like when I come off the left lead, I want him to come really straight and stay really straight and hold his left lead all the way through the exercise. And when I come off the right lead, same thing. And just really working on getting him straight and keeping him straight. And I feel like it helps him sort of stay on his hind end and be really sharp and quick with his front end. And it's an exercise we did with him early. And like I said, now it's almost just habit. And it's one that I think he knows when that exercise comes out and Tim's out there early in the morning setting it up that it means it's a big day.
Yeah.
For my ladies and for my younger horses, we always have a line of Cavalettis set in the ring that can be done in 5 or 6. And we practice a lot of do the Cavalettis in 6, sit in the saddle and collect, do the Cavalettis in 5, you know, stay a little looser on their back. So I think like lengthening and collecting without people being able to see it is something that's very important in the hunters, because the idea of it is that the horses are trained to small changes in your body and so that it's not visible what you're doing. So my horses learn that when I close my hip angle a little bit, it means that I want them to lengthen. And when I sit in the saddle, that I want them to collect. So that's definitely an exercise that we always have set up at home and that we work on a lot. There's countless other gymnastics that we add in or practice sort of depending on the horse and their needs and the time of year and what's going on.
So we've talked about kind of exercises for horses. Is there a certain fitness routine that you follow or any exercises that you like to do for yourself to stay fit?
Yeah, I love Pilates. I've done Pilates for years now. So certainly anytime that I can do that, I do. It gets a little hard especially when we're in Florida doing this like 12-week circuit, because my only day off is Monday. But I have a personal trainer that I go to. I try to get there twice a week. Monday and Thursday evenings. Sometimes the Thursday evenings, I don't make it just because we're still horse showing. But I do like mostly weight training, not that much cardio, but a lot of stretching and a lot of weight training. And then I add in Pilates when I can. I love like reformer Pilates. And I think that's a great exercise for riders.
Gotcha. Yeah. It's kind of interesting to hear people's, you know, everyone's kind of preferences and what works for them and maybe sparks other people's minds like, oh, I could maybe add that to my fitness routine as well to get a bit stronger for my horse.
I also find the chiropractor to be really important. And actually when we're here in Florida, my boyfriend and I, we have a weekly chiropractor appointment, but I just think that if we're not symmetrical in the saddle, all of our asymmetry goes directly to our horses and causes their asymmetry. So, and I know that I'm not born perfectly straight. Like I feel like my hips are always needing to be adjusted. And so I do really try to keep on top of that, not only for my own well-being, but I just feel like I said, anything that's not straight or symmetrical in my body, it directly goes to theirs. And I've seen that before, you know, like when the vets are working on the horses and, you know, the ones that I ride consistently will have similar issues as far as like, you know, where they're not totally even.
Sure.
So I think that, yeah. So I think that's really important. I mean, I'm a spa girl, so I like to do all the things, but when I have to narrow it down to a couple of things because of lack of time, I definitely pick the chiropractor and some weight training.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You know, if we're wanting our horses to be straight, we want to be straight as well, not contribute to any crookedness. So you've answered most of my questions. I just have a couple wrap-up questions for you.
Sure.
So what is the hardest part of the sport for you?
Oh, I think the hardest part of the sport for me is dealing with everybody else's expectations. Like I understand, you know, that we're riding animals and I celebrate the successes, but I expect that there's going to be hard days and there's going to be losses and there's going to be injuries, but I have a hard time. I don't want anybody else to be disappointed. And The hardest part is like when you have to communicate to your owners that there's a problem, either that there's an injury with the horse or, I don't know, a setback with the horse, or you had a bad day or so. I think that's the hardest thing for me, is like just managing everybody else's expectations. And, you know, sometimes you just feel like there's the weight of a lot of people riding on your shoulders. And I just have to remind myself that we're all human and we're riding animals, and that there's going to be highs and lows and good days and bad days, and things are going to happen no matter how diligent and organized and responsible you are. So, sure. But I definitely think that's the hard part. The horses are easy. It's, you know, dealing with everything else.
Sure. Yeah, definitely a challenge for professionals, and what, you know, kind of the different aspects of the career that you have to deal with.
Yeah.
And with kind of being a professional, and you've had your career for several years, is there any advice that you would give your younger self?
I don't know. I think probably it is very related to my last answer, which is just trying not to get too wrapped up in trying to be perfect and trying to please everybody else. I mean, obviously, I'm working in a customer-based business, so it's my job to do my job and try to make everybody as happy as I can. But it's just easy to feel a lot of stress and pressure from those outside sources, and mostly just to try to have confidence in what I'm doing and not get wrapped up in everybody else's sort of worries and things like that. I don't know if I expressed that perfectly, but and I think I actually learned this pretty early on, but I think the whole idea of that this is really such a large team. It's the team that it requires to get these horses to be successful and to keep them being successful is enormous. I mean, it's myself, it's my boyfriend, Tim, it's all the guys that work for me and the girls that work for me. But then it goes down to the farrier and the vet and the feed company and the saddle maker. I mean, it's so many people that contribute to this all going well. And if one of those things is out of whack, like the whole thing can sort of fall apart.
Oh yeah, that's true. Just, you know, we think a lot about kind of us and our horses in the ring, but there's a big team of supporters that help get us there and, you know, make a lot of times make us successful. And in your opinion, what makes a good horse person?
Oh my goodness. I think somebody who can listen to horses. Mm-hmm. I think that you really have to, you know, evaluate each horse on a day-to-day basis, and you have to be able to listen to what they're telling you, and you have to understand that they might not be on your timeline. So, you know, you can go to Europe and buy a fancy young five-year-old, and some of them might come here and just immediately be ready to go to the ring and have no setbacks and have so much success. And there might be others that take a year or two or three to get there. And you can't expect that they're going to go on your timeline. Like they can only go on their timeline, and you have to evaluate that daily, how they feel, how they look, you know, what they're able to accomplish, and make sure that you're doing the best thing for them, not what everybody else is expecting of you or of them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, yeah, can't rush things. And if you try, it usually doesn't pay out for anyone, you or the horse.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of thinking about what's, you know, the year ahead, what, and maybe even just the next few months or weeks ahead, what's next for you and your horses?
So we are going into week 12 of WECOCALA, which is our last week. And then we stay in Ocala until the end of April. The horses get a little time away from the show and get their vaccinations and their vet checkups, and the people all get to recover a little bit. And then we head from here to Aiken, South Carolina. We go to 2 weeks of horse shows at Bruce's Field, the Aiken Charity Horse Shows. which are two of my favorites of the year. I love Aiken, and it's a really well-run sort of small boutique show that really concentrates on the hunters. From there, we head back to our northern base in New Jersey. So I think we leave Aiken on May 11th and head to New Jersey. And then we start up with our whole summer circuit, which starts with Devon, quickly followed by Upperville. And then we spend 2 weeks in Lake Placid, a little time in Saugerties, and then Derby Finals in August, which is always a big week, Green Incentive and Derby Finals. So we're, you know, we love Florida so much, but we're getting excited to start our summer routine.
Thanks for listening to this week's conversation with Amanda Stege. And a big thank you to the episode's sponsor, Equa Analytical. Learn more at equaanalytical.com. You can listen to the Practical Horseman podcast on your favorite podcast player or on horseradionetwork.com. While you're there, be sure to like, subscribe, and leave a review. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Kathleen Landwehr, and you've been listening to the Practical Horseman podcast.